Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
I'm your host, John Sandage. My guest tonight, as what happens every month, is Dr. Dawn Motyka, and we'll be learning about medical facts, fallacies. Welcome to Dr. Dawn Motyka. How are you, Don?
Oh, I'm just fine. How are you today?
Great. Well, I'm glad you've held up under all this disease, it seems, that half the United States is suffering with.
Well, you know, it's been a bad flu season, or I should say, as we are in the midst of it, it is being a bad flu season.
And, you know, being a physician, you're put in that place all the time. How do you protect yourself? Do you wear a mask when you're working with people and that have these problems?
Well, I have masks in the office, and if someone is really, you know, coughing, I might put a mask on. In the hospital, certainly, as I go into a patient's room, if they have something bad enough to put them in the hospital right now, a lot of us are walking around with masks at the hospitals. And I think obsessive hand washing is another disease that you catch, OCD, hand washing disease. In medicine, so that's another thing that's really important. Also, I think there's an advantage to low-level exposures, because if you get just a little taste of something, it's kind of like a vaccination. It's how vaccination works. You get a little taste, not enough to really make you sick, but enough to familiarize your immune system with that particular entity. And I believe that after several years of teaching, teachers will probably tell you they stop getting as many colds the first couple of years. They have a cold constantly. The first couple of years on the wards, one tends to be sick all the time at a sort of low level. And then after that, your immune system seems to improve. And actually, one of the stories I have for us today talks a little bit about some of the mechanism of that. So,
good segue.
Well, I guess
we can segue into that.
We can segue right to that. I will be bringing up some interesting stuff about the microbiome in surfers and how it differs from that of non-surfers, even people who swim. But surfing actually has a difference, so stay tuned for that as well. But let's go it in a different order. The immune system is an extremely complicated system, and we're beginning to tease apart the pieces. A recent study showed that a Western diet, high-fat, high-calorie diet, actually causes the immune system to react similarly to a bacterial infection. So unhealthy food, fast food, makes the body's defenses not just inflamed in the short run, but it actually predisposes you to react more strongly with your immune system in the long run through causing epigenetic changes. So I think that epigenetic changes may also be at work in the phenomenon that I just described with doctors and grade school teachers. So in this study, they took some mice and they fed them a Western diet, high in fat, high in sugar, low in fiber, essentially a super size me diet. And the animals consistently developed a strong inflammatory response throughout their body. It's like their number of white cells went up, their granulocytes went up, their monocytes went up, so there was more circulating in the bloodstream, there was more coming out of the bone marrow. So they decided, well, let's pull some bone marrow from these mice, which must have been fun because mice are small. And getting a needle into the bone marrow, well, I suppose that that's an expertise that postdoc students get. Anyway, so they did show that the genes responsible for growth and maturation of the immune system were altered. So you could say that fast food causes your body to become inflamed and call out the National Guard. Of course, if you don't have an infection to treat, that inflammation is actually hard on your body. It creates something called oxidative stress, which wears out your arteries and wears out your tissues and is actually pro-cancerous, so not so good. Here's what's spooky, though. So they took the mice and they fed them their normal grain diet, and the inflammatory cells all went away. The bloodstream returned to normal, but the genetic changes stayed put. So they were still the inflammasome, which is kind of like a master control signal that turns on a whole bunch of DNA and starts it dividing, was activated. Once it was activated, it stayed activated. And they drilled down a little bit, and they found that what was really going on with the unhealthy eating is we normally think of DNA as being in chromosomes, and you think of chromosomes as these wound up bits of DNA, wound, hyper around each other, and then wound around again, so that you take this very, very long string of DNA and can cram it down into a little cell. And you do that by twisting it up. But you are actually twisting the DNA onto these little spindles called histones. They look a little bit like spools of thread. And the DNA is in this epigenetic change that they've demonstrated just from the Western diet. You unroll the histones. So ordinarily, when you want to make DNA from that rolled up piece of make RNA from that rolled up piece of DNA, you have to unwind it, and that creates a delay. But if it's already unwound and just kind of sitting there blowing in the breeze, then it's very easy for any kind of inflammatory event to trigger that DNA production. So essentially, you make more inflammatory signals more rapidly if you've been exposed to the Western diet, and this is a persistent effect. Now, I think in the case of where we started out, which was with the flu, people who have been exposed probably have a more rapid response for a while to further inflammation. And we also know this. If you look in people who've just had a heart attack, or you look in the plaque that ruptured, you'll often find viral or bacterial DNA. And the thinking is that bacteria or viral DNA got into the system, got into the person, and actually triggered the inflammasome. And then the inflammasome being upregulated contributed to shoveling more fat into the plaque. Because it turns out when those new granulocytes and monocytes come out of the bone marrow and start wandering around, the very first place they go is the blood vessel wall. And if they find a plaque, they'll burrow on into it.
Can I ask a couple of quick clarifications?
Sure.
Clarifications. What histones?
Histones are a little structure, a microstructure inside the nucleus, and the DNA is wound around. Part of the way you collapse that DNA down into a string that won't tangle is you wind it up around these histones. Think about under your desk, all those cords and wires and things, and you can go and buy these little spools and wind the cords onto it to shorten them so they don't get all tangled. It's exactly what a histone is.
Interesting. I hadn't heard that word before. And in our, you mentioned fat foods fast foods is the mm-hmm. problem. Well, there's a lot of different kinds of fast foods. How do you know which ones would be the problem? Is it in the cooking of them? Or how do you?
Well, okay, so basically you're looking at high fat, typically a vegetable oil now, used to be trans fat, but mostly that's being phased out of most fast food. High sugar, high starch. So those are the things that are inflammatory in a diet. Proteins are not particularly inflammatory.
Okay. Caught up now. All right. Moving forward.
Okay. So that was the fast food in the immune system. And let's talk about surfers.
Yeah, that interested me when you brought that one up.
Yeah, well,
sure.
The microbiome is one of my favorite topics next to epigenetics. So see, I've already had a good evening. I got to talk about some of my favorite things.
I'm a good date.
All right. Well, coming back to the surfers, this study was done in England, but I think we can presume that it probably would apply here, probably apply more so here, because the British don't they don't have quite as many people pooping in Soquel Creek as we do. So by the time the water gets down to the ocean, there's quite a lot of E. coli in our coastal waters here. And in the case of surfers, researchers estimate that surfers swallow about 10 times more water than swimmers, ocean swimmers do. And so what they did was they got 300 very cooperative Brits, and I would have loved to have, "Hello, sir, my name is Dr. Jones, and I'm doing research on the human microbiome. Would you please take this swab and place it where the sun don't shine?" So they went out to the beach, and they collected 300 rectal swabs, 150 surfers and 150 swimmers. And then they subjected them to analysis, and they found a couple of alarming things. First of all, looking at drug resistance, the surfers have about 3 times higher rate of having drug-resistant bacteria in their colon. And drug-resistant bacteria, in particular, that contained plasmids. So let me explain what a plasmid is. We're getting all this basic science. I love it. So a plasmid is a ring, kind of like those round key rings with a little notch on both ends so that you open it and close it, and you've got a circle with a bunch of keys on it. So if you think of that as a circle of DNA that can unhook and insert itself into another string of DNA in another bacteria, you've got a plasmid. And bacteria can trade plasmids, kind of like you might trade baseball cards or something. So if you've got bacteria, if you've got antibiotic-resistant plasmids in your E. coli, that plasmid can leave the E. coli and it can jump into whatever other bacteria is there. It doesn't have, it's not species specific. So these plasmids can jump into Klebsiella, they can jump into Proteus, they can jump into other gut flora and infect those gut flora. So then the person gets a urinary tract infection and the antibiotics don't work because the bacteria, which came from the rectum, is caught, if you will, from the plasmid bacterial resistance. And we are looking at a real crisis in antibiotic resistance in the world. The UN has declared this, you know, one of the 10 looming things that will destroy us. You know, they're such cheerful people.
Yes. Here's the top 10.
Although it's hard to be cheerful right now. Anyway, so the concept is that if you're a surfer, you can pretty much assume you're going to be exposed to nasty bacteria. And I learned a trick from a Peace Corps volunteer when I was in Egypt. And here it is. You chew up 4 Pepto-Bismol tablets before you go surfing.
Hmm.
Or in the case of the Peace Corps volunteer, it was before you eat at the chief's house, you chew up 4 because you got to have to eat and you don't want to get sick. And the bismuth in the Pepto-Bismol will actually make your stomach extremely toxic to any bacteria that get into your mouth in the next couple of hours.
What is it?
Pepto-Bismol. Bismuth.
Bismuth is what is? Where does that come
bismuth
from?
Bismuth is a metallic element that I believe it's an element. You know, physical chemistry was not my strong suit, but it is a compound that is like a metal, and it, if it isn't actually a metal, and it will, it's toxic. So it's kind of like silver is also toxic to bacteria, and a lot of people use colloidal silver as an antibacterial. The nice thing about these metallic antibacterials is it's very difficult for the bacteria to become resistant to it. It can become easily resistant to certain kinds of penicillin-like drugs because they can make an enzyme that will break down that active agent, the drug. But they can't make an enzyme that's going to break down silver or bismuth. So we're not going to see resistance there. And it's a fairly straightforward way to protect yourself.
It makes a lot of sense. So surfers, four
Pepto-Bismol tablets, and you will poop black the next day. Do not be alarmed.
And how long before you go in the water?
Right away.
You're going in?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
It'll last for about 90 minutes, and then you might want to refresh your dose. But
90 minutes is a good long session for most people. Some of the surfers can stay out all day, but 90 minutes is a pretty long time to be surfing.
I should think so. It's pretty aerobic.
Pretty strenuous sport.
Pretty aerobic sport. Okay.
Well, very interesting. I was expecting you were going to say, well, surfers, because of what they're doing and in the fresh air and blah, 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 have built up a great healthy regimen and don't get sick as often. But it's almost the opposite because of the environment they go into.
Well, you see, they may have good host defenses, so they may get sick less often. But when they do get sick, particularly certain kinds of sick that would be related to gut flora, so the urinary tract infections is a big one, and throwing up, if you vomit the bacteria that you vomited, if you suck any of that into your lungs, which can happen, you know, just from the part of the throwing up process, you can actually get gram-negative pneumonias, and those drug-resistant gram-negative pneumonia is mucho bad. All right. Well, we're going to do a light one and then a couple heavy ones, and then I'll
break it up a little bit.
Yeah. So,
well, I have another question when you get to the
end. I know. Let's talk about melanoma.
Yeah.
This is one of the worst cancers. And part of the reason it's such a terrible cancer is that it can masquerade as a nice, normal-looking mole. It can show up under your toenail. It can show up in your mouth, in the back of your eyeball, places where you wouldn't even see it. And it has a tendency to spread early. So by the time a melanoma has gotten to the size of the pink pencil eraser on the top of a pencil, that's big enough that there's a substantial probability it will have spread. So we need to spot them early, but we all knew that. But researchers are always looking for information about melanoma and also trying to understand why it is that the immune system has such a hard time seeing it. Now, Jimmy Carter had melanoma, and they gave him a melanoma vaccine that was made from his own cancer. And you can do that. We've now gotten to the point where we can essentially raise up monoclonal antibodies against a particular cancer and then give that to the person. And if the stars align, you can actually throw that person into remission. And that's what happened with Mr. Carter.
He deserved a break.
I'm very grateful that it happened to him.
Yeah,
I think
me too.
He's, a force for sanity in the world, and long may he wave. But getting back to this, if we could solve the mystery of how the melanomas are escaping immune surveillance, then we might be able to treat it much more effectively. And so these researchers were looking into exactly what's going on with melanomas, and they discovered exactly how that's happening. And the melanomas actually release a molecule that shifts the dendritic cells. And the dendritic cells are like these big amoebas that wander around, and they eat things. And then they put them on their surface, kind of like one of those hermit crabs, that decorate themselves with they put all the little bits of seaweed and things on their surface. But the immune system sends these immature newborn T cells, the ones that just came out of the bone marrow, and they'll bounce into one of the things that's sitting on the surface of the dendritic cell. And the dendritic cell will actually reach out and grab the T cell and say, like you would take a hound dog and put the shoe of the person that you're trying to track in front of the hound dog and then say, go find him. And the hound dog runs off barking. Well, the T cell does that. It runs off barking. It has now been trained to attack that little fragment of stuff that was sitting on the surface of the dendritic cell. So that little arm, that little grabber arm that comes out and grabs the T cell and holds it and says, here, this is what we want you to be chasing, that can be suppressed by the melanoma cells. So literally, the melanoma cells are turning off the T cell production. And they actually, the result of turning this down is that you actually raise the number of suppressor cells. So what are called the T repressor cells go up, and the active ones that attack the antigens go down. This is really important, because once you find the name of the regulatory enzyme, then you can start to attack it. But remember I said that certain diets and inflammation are related to cancer? Well, it turns out that this immune suppression, that the mechanism that is being exploited by the T cells, is actually increased during a high fatty acid diet. So it's very intriguing, because here we are eating fast food, which is high in fat, and that raises inflammation. But then there's a little back mechanism where fat actually turns down the immune system. So are we looking at a compensatory mechanism, or is this just an accident that these two things showed up in my desk? I mean, I'm just speculating here, because this is what makes science so interesting. It's this deep dive into this convoluted pattern of interaction and feedback that is this beautiful tapestry and web that you can spend your lifetime just appreciating.
Let me, before you move on to the next subject here, I talked to a friend today who's been had cancer for about 10 years now and been fighting it with a diet. And he has been taking a treatment in Duluth, Minnesota, and says his cancer is gone. He's cancer clear. And he says that they have been telling him, and I'd like to get your opinion on this, that there has been, the cancer has been curable since 1902. And Big Med, Big Farm have suppressed the cure because it would change the economic situation and medical treatment so radically that it would throw everything off and, of course, cost people a lot, different people a lot of money. Is this a weird, just another one of the hoax theories trying to get people to be treated for something? Or is there some possibility that that's true? Or are you sworn to secrecy?
Well, I'm not sworn to secrecy. I think it's really far-fetched that you could hold together a coordinated conspiracy. I mean, think, just it, the merits of the argument aside, and there's no question that companies buy up patents and delay or don't release them because they have they own the market and they don't want a competitive product coming along. I mean, that sort of thing does happen.
Yeah.
It's not secret. You can, if you're watching, you can see it. And I report on it a lot. But I'm thinking
illegal?
About, well, think about this book that just came out, the anti-Trump book, and I don't want to talk politics, but it's a good example of how hard it is to keep a lid on humans.
Yeah.
Okay. This guy basically sat in the lobby and talked to people. He didn't actually have appointments with most of them. They saw him. He was a reporter. Everybody assumed he was kind of supposed to be there. He was waiting to see Bannon. And he was waiting to see Bannon every day. He had he made an appointment, went in, sat there, and chatted with people, and they would talk to him. And that's how people are. So, you know, it would take a lot of people to pull off this conspiracy, and I don't think you could do it.
Well, I agree with you because the conspiracy theories, it's like the cloud thing.
You know,
How can you keep that a secret?
Would have to be very, very few people.
Yeah,
okay.
And now they got planes flying all over the world, being loaded with whatever they're putting up there to spray, and the pilots and all of the crew, and how you could not keep that a secret?
Somebody would talk.
Absolutely. That's what I thought about this, but I don't want to say to somebody that's going, I'm feeling so good.
I hear this all the time. And it's, you know, in alternative land.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, there's also a pill that you can put in your gas tank with water and you don't need to buy gasoline.
Ever.
And that's been suppressed by, you know, big petroleum. And, you know, I think it's natural that these stories arise. But the first thing I do is step back, pull out my Occam's razor and say, could this even happen? I mean, not even looking at the merits of the specifics, but just, is it plausible that you could get people to behave this way? And do it for 117 years or 116 years.
Yeah. Well, struck me.
Is this ESSIAC that they're doing? Because the stuff that's been around since, there's not that many things that go back to 1901.
Yeah. You know, he was in treatment. He said, I've got to go. He told me these stories. He says, I feel so good and I'm so happy and I've discovered this and I'll talk to you when I get back home. He was flying home tomorrow.
Well, so. I sincerely hope that his regimen included, you know, a very, very high vegetable material diet.
Because, well, that's what he's been doing for 10 years. He's an expert dietitian over 10 years of practicing this.
I believe that you can alter this is true. I believe that you can alter the speed that the cancer kills you with diet. And if you can slow it down enough, you might get to die of something else before it kills you. So you can kind of have a stalemate or a kind of a North and South Korea situation where, you know, what was that, 1947 that they set up that line and it, it was the 50s.
I'm old enough for that.
So when ended, the Korean War ended in 1954. And so that must be when they set up that no man's line. Yeah.
Where you see there's soldiers on both sides and there's this open, you know, the no man's land, so to speak.
Right.
And you mentioned his name and I want to ask you about his health report. They said he is just almost obese. So what is almost obese? How much do you have to weigh to be obese?
Okay, so to be obese, you have to have a BMI of greater than 30. So a BMI is basically a algorithm where you, and I don't remember the mathematical equation, but essentially you take the person's height and you take their person's weight, you run it through a calculation, and you get a number.
Yeah.
And The healthy number is 25, is 19 to 25. If you're below, if you're in the 18s and below, you're much more likely to die of a disease because you're too thin and you don't, you're probably malnourished or you have a disease that's made you that thin. So it's more likely that you'll get sick. Then if, when you get to 26, the, and between 27, it starts to be a little iffy, gray zone. When you get to 27, the disease risk rate for hypertension, cancer, diabetes starts to go up, kind of in a steep slope. And it keeps getting steeper and steeper and steeper. So between 27 and 29, you're in the danger zone, but you aren't, you're not looking at more than, you know, maybe double the risk for heart disease and diabetes. When you get into the obese category, it goes up to like 10 times. And then when you get into the super obese, which is a BMI of 40, you get into 20, 30 times the risk of early death from all of the causes I've mentioned.
Oh, well, here's a call. Thank you very much. You're on the air with Dr. Don Motyka.
Hi, my name is Archie, and it's my first time calling.
Well, thank you.
Hi.
Hi. Both of you.
But it's interesting for me because I have not checked myself, but I have been told that it's been printed in the American Journal of Medicine that if your system is more alkaline than acid, that it's really hard for most cancers to even start. And I do know that if you're more alkaline, that you do avoid a lot of trouble with a lot of medical stuff. There's less inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just curious what you had to say about that.
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is step back and talk about the problem of correlation versus causation. So correlation is where you see something and they are occurring in the same space or at the same time. So for example, if you have sunshine and you have people wearing bikinis, you could say, well, maybe the bikinis are causing the sunshine, but that would not be right. It would be the opposite direction, right? It would be, but so if we go, if we put on bikinis and go stand out in the rain, it will not make the sun come out. But you could see how you might, you know, make that connection, but it would be wrong. But it would be an accurate correlation, but it wouldn't be causal. So causation is where you prove that the sun causes the bikinis or the bikinis cause the sun. Correlation is where everybody agrees that they both tend to occur at the same time. Still with me?
Yeah, I think so.
All right.
I think so.
Okay, so now we're going to move to acid and alkaline. So you have to ask, well, what is acid or alkaline? Now, if I look in the bloodstream, the kidneys keep the blood pH in a very narrow range called the range that you can stay alive, which is about from 7.2 to 7.4. When you get much below 7.2 or much above 7.45, the biochemical processes in your body don't work as well, and they start to run awry, and you begin to have problems doing things like making energy or breathing or having your nerves work. So it's
when you get too alkaline?
No. In the bloodstream, if you get too alkaline, you die. And if you get too acidic, you die. Either way, they're neither of them good. So we it's really impossible to shift the bloodstream very much because the kidneys are going to dump, if you take too much acid, the kidneys are going to dump bicarbonate into the bloodstream to bring the pH up, and if you or make you hyperventilate to bring the pH up, get rid of some acid by blowing it off as CO2. So you've got so where we look for to say, okay, this person's alkaline or this person acidic is we look at their urine. And we say, well, if their urine is alkaline, then we can say, okay, realistically, that's something I can measure that will correlate with certain things, particularly diet. So if I'm eating a lot of vegetables, vegetables are very alkaline. So if I am a vegetarian and I'm eating a lot of vegetables, my my urine will tend to be alkaline. And is it the alkaline that's also correlating with the fact that I get, in other words, here we go to the correlation versus the causality.
Okay.
The alkaline is present in the healthy individual. The vegetables are present in the healthy individual. Is the alkaline causing the health, or are the vegetables causing the health, and the alkaline urine is just a side effect of the vegetables? And so when you read these statements about, you know, alkaline, it's like, yes, that's true, but it doesn't prove, and nobody has been able really to prove, despite trying, that making the urine alkaline all by itself does all that much against cancer, or, you know, preventing it from taking hold. You have to get the alkaline in the body tissues, and there we get data from test tubes, what we call in vitro, in glass. So if I've got a cell culture of breast cancer cells growing in tissue culture, and I make that tissue culture more acidic, obviously there's no kidney to regulate it, and up to a point, you can show that the cancer cells prefer an acidic environment. And I think what's more important is that when you put non-cancer cells in an acidic environment, they start turning on DNA that's more associated with cancer. So it's almost like the acidic environment is shifting the what we would call the proteasome. In other words, the genes that are being turned on and turned into proteins change according to the environment of the test tube or the petri dish. Mm-hmm. So we've established that, and we've established that there's an association or a correlation, which is where this claim that you're reading is coming from. So when I look at all the data across the spectrum, I say, all right, I think the alkalinity of the urine, at least, which is the only thing we can measure, is an indicator under most circumstances of tissue cell, if the person, and then you look at the diet. But the real cause of the decreased cancer is the diet, not the alkalinity. And ditto for, you know, an acidic diet. So if you're eating a lot of fast food, you're eating a lot of starch, simple carbohydrates, I mean, not complex carbohydrates. You're eating a lot of fat and high protein. And this is, you know, I love high protein, but protein is made of amino acids. Ooh, wait a minute. So it's good to realize that if you're going to eat a high protein diet, you better eat a high vegetable diet, because you're going to need to compensate for all the acidity that you're bringing into your body. And you want essentially to have your body tissues be a bit more on the alkaline than the acidic range of tissue health. But you but again, like I'm saying, the body will self-regulate, so you can only push it so far. And, you know, if I wanted to make my urine alkaline, I could just eat some bicarbonate, you know, some baking soda.
Lemon water.
Right. And I don't think that that's going to make me healthy. I think that's what we call a third variable problem, where the people are focusing on the correlation and they've gotten the arrow of cause confused.
Okay. Thank you.
And thanks for your call.
Sure. Could I actually mention one other thing about that?
Sure.
Yeah, it's a similar thing, which is just that, okay, I knew someone that had one of these diseases that was from too much inflammation in the body. And so he just functioned on a low level and rented houses and sold pot for years. He just felt like there was nothing he could do, really, but just kind of sit around. And so he heard, but it was a disease that where there was a lot of inflammation in the body present.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was told that the silkworms have something in their stomach that they release when they're ready to dissolve the cocoon, and that will eat inflammation in your body.
Now, there's a good question. Let's let Don take that one, and thank you for calling.
Okay. So let me just say that you can't eat inflammation. I think what we're looking at here is lumbrokinase, which is a proteolytic enzyme that breaks down proteins. And one of the things that is an there's all these inflammatory signals, a bunch of them. One of the ones is antibody antigen complexes. So basically, after your antibody grabs onto the thing it's targeted for, now you've got a lump in your circulation and you got to get rid of it. And you can use proteolytic enzymes like lumbrokinase or serrapeptidase, which are sold commercially as health foods, to break up these immune complexes. And they do seem to be helpful for that kind of an inflammatory disease.
Thank you. You are on the air with Dr. Don Motyka.
Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. Our son was recently diagnosed with a condition called Perthes disease. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I know it is Leg Calve Perthes disease, but yes, I think they've shortened it. Yes, so go ahead.
And we're trying to find information on like nutritional supplementation or other kinds of ways to both reduce inflammation and kind of promote bone growth. And there's really nothing that we've found, and I don't know if you have any recommendations on sort of things to look at, but I know it's avascular necrosis, I think is the technical term. So it's like, is that similar to osteoporosis or something you might recommend for that?
Yeah, it's completely different. So this is actually an infarction. So if you think in terms of like a myocardial infarction, it's a heart attack. Well, this is a bone infarction. So the part of the bone at the hip bone and up in the socket, there's a cartilage growth plate, and that's where all of the new bone is being laid down to grow the length. So you've got one growth plate at the knee and another one up there at the hip. And it's, as you might imagine, you know, growing bone is a very energy, uses a lot of energy, uses a lot of calories, uses a lot of calcium, and needs a decent blood supply to truck that stuff in. And in this, it's a fairly rare condition, but what happens is that you don't get enough blood to that bone, and the bone dies. And the cause is really not understood. It seems it's just something happens that interferes with the blood supply. So the bone itself dies, collapses, and loses its shape. And it's usually young children during that who are growing very rapidly. And it definitely changes the shape of the femoral head because the bone collapses a little bit on itself. Now you develop collaterals, and so you eventually start growing again, but you end up with a twist and a change in the shape of the leg. And so this can have long-term implications, and often is treated conservatively while you're still growing. Sometimes they'll use splints or actually put something called an external fixator, which is, a metal rod with a couple of screws going into the bone, and they'll take the weight off of the hip so that the femur can regrow. And there's all sorts of, there's a Perthes Association. I don't know if you've been to their website, but that's important to know that there is help out there. Now, thinking in terms of nutrition, you mentioned, would I use things that I would use for osteoporosis? And in osteoporosis, you've got an imbalance between bone buildup and bone breakdown, and you're breaking it down faster than you're building it up. So we treat that, at least at the first stage, with lots of calcium, lots of vitamin D, lots of vitamin K. And those are things that would be reasonable to do in a child as well. You need to monitor vitamin D levels, but there'd be nothing wrong with pushing them up to, say, 50 in a child. And the calcium, you basically take, you look at the weight of the child and you divide that by an adult weight and use 1,000. And so, like, if the child weighs 75 pounds, you might consider an adult weight to be 150. So you'd say, okay, well, half of an adult weight, so that would be 500 milligrams of calcium in a day. And so that's kind of how I, and you could probably get away with 1,000 milligrams, but I'd have to look it up, so don't take that as gospel. The, you know, eventually, it may be in early middle age, is it your son or your daughter?
Son.
Yeah. Your son may be one, may need whatever is the technology then for a hip replacement. It's, you know, maybe a quarter of people will respond to that. And, yeah, so nutritionally, that those are the things that I would know about and don't have much other information for you.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks. Yeah, I've looked at the website. There is some information, but there is very little proof, like functional medicine or, you know, kind of more holistic approaches. You know, it's very much towards, you know,
yeah, it's
operation. Basically do an operation or you do nothing.
Yeah,
depending on the stage.
Right, exactly, and where it's at and how bad it is and what the shape is and whether it's a functional joint or not. But this
I guess it doesn't have a pharmaceutical fix, so nobody's really interested in funding a lot of research on it.
It has a low probability of success. You know, when you decide what you're going to fund, you tend to look at what's likely to yield. And this is true of structural problems. You know, so you talk about, let's say, knee arthritis or something like that. We've got a few drugs that are good anti-inflammatories and a large number of natural things I've talked about on this program that are anti-inflammatories. But eventually, when you lose all the cartilage and you're rubbing bone against bone, it's a structural problem, and you can't eat your way or supplement your way out of structural problems is a general rule.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Dr. Don.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don.
Well, good evening.
Good evening.
Very deep voice, Dr. Don.
Well, I think I'm a little throatier than usual today.
Oh, okay. Anyway, having a slightly higher cholesterol count, my doctor recommended I get a carotid sonogram.
Mm-hmm.
And after a little bit of time, he got the report, called me in, and pointed out, you know, the carotid seems to be a little clogged up.
Mm-hmm.
And so just going, blank, you know. What? And then the mind is reading, oh, God, I'm short of breath. Oh, you know, I'm reading all the terrible symptoms. I'm going to die. Which is a given.
You are. Hate to break it to you.
Yeah, oh, damn.
She went to school for years to learn to say that.
But with sensitivity, always.
Okay. You know, I have contacted the Trident Society, and I'm set.
Okay.
But
in the meantime, though.
In the meantime, I've succumbed to taking a statin to thin out the blood a little bit, and what can one do, and any operations down the line, or just
well? Okay, so let's go back to the carotid.
Yes.
So you had a standard ultrasound, right? You didn't have anything sophisticated. You just went down to the local radiology or hospital, and they walked right in and they looked at your carotid, right?
I had the initial one at the doctor's office. He has a physician fly in once a month or so to do sonograms and get the readout. Then, subsequently, I was sent down to the radiology readout for a more intensive one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I'm going to have another stress test. And then he's going to talk to me again.
Okay. So there's yet another level of carotid artery evaluation. I was just checking to see whether you had had that one. That one's called a carotid intimal medial thickness, and it's a more sophisticated ultrasound, and it isn't offered generally at the local hospitals. In fact, it's not available in this county at all, so I know you probably didn't have that one. So we're talking about plaque. that in your carotid artery that's probably at least 15 or 20% of narrowing before you can reliably see it on that technology. Do you remember a percentage, like a 30% lesion or anything like that from your discussion with your doctor?
You know, you just kind of go blank.
Gotcha.
You
know, okay, that's fine if you don't remember the number. But what it what we look at is we have these thresholds in medicine. So if somebody walks in and they've got a 50% lesion, in other words, there's this area in the carotid where it's 50% narrower than it should be because of some plaque in there, and they have no symptoms, then the treatment for something that would be 50% or under would be, oh yeah, let's put you on a statin. And by the way, a statin doesn't thin the blood. It lowers cholesterol and it lowers inflammation. So it acts to reduce the speed that you're going to accumulate more plaque and have it get narrower. All right, that's the action of the statin. Now, with respect to the other things that we have to think about here, if a person has a mini stroke, we call those a TIA, and you look in there and they've got a 50% lesion, you would probably give them a blood thinner, like Xarelto or Eliquis or one of the new ones, which are more expensive but a heck of a lot more convenient for everybody. So most people are using those. But I still have a bunch of people on Coumadin because it's way cheaper and I don't mind looking at labs once a month. But the in any event, you'd be put on something that would tend to reduce the tendency of your blood to clot and start throwing blood clots at your brain from that plaque. And if you have a 75% or 70% narrowing, that means you've only got 30% left, then the odds start to favor surgery. And then and only then, and then and only if you're symptomatic. Because it turns out that the surgery itself gives you a stroke about 10% of the time. So you don't do the surgery unless the risk of the stroke is greater than 10%.
Well, let's put it this way. Anytime you go into surgery, you're signing that paper. Oh, well, if something happens, oh, well, you know.
Can't say we didn't warn you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you something, sir. I'll tell you how the law works in this country, and it stinks. But if I don't tell you and something does happen, from the legal standpoint, that I didn't do the surgery right. I gave you that problem. I am completely negligent and liable for if I didn't tell you that this could happen, then it's like I cursed you with it. I have culpability, which is kind of a crazy standard, because what it means is that we have to scare the nuts off of people every time we do something, and which is, you know, just a stupid thing to do before you're going to be trying to make someone well, is to scare them to death. And yet, if we don't scare you to death, and something does go wrong, it's our fault, which, you know, is crazy. And they don't do this in other countries, by the way. It's a stupid thing. But we have a lot of uniquely American stupid things in our healthcare system. We don't need to belabor that point. Getting back to what you should be doing, because there's a whole bunch of things you should be doing besides just taking that statin. And one of them is really clean up your act with respect to what you're putting in your mouth. And start exercising, and, you know, under guidance if you haven't been exercising, but you got to take up exercise. You got to start eating really clean, lots of vegetables, lots of fiber.
You're preaching to the choir.
Yeah. So you picked the wrong parents, dude. Then, if you got because
but I'm adopted.
Well,
you still picked the wrong parents.
Well, according to Tibetan Buddhism, you do choose your parents.
Yeah.
So I'm not a devout anything, but I like the idea that you're kind of wandering around in outer space and you see people making love and you say, oh, I like
I'll
that one. I just like that. I think that's great. You know, that's a great way to choose parents, don't you?
Good as anything we've been doing so far.
Okay, so you might take a look at Pridican or Dean Ornish. Those diets have both been shown to reduce plaque. Dean Ornish has a diet called the Spectrum Diet, and I have Pritikin's called the Pritikin Plan. So, you know, if you're doing all that, so go look, pull a book from the library. And if you're doing all that stuff, you're probably going to need to stay on your statin. And by the way, if you're on a statin, you need to be taking at least 100 milligrams, better 200 milligrams a day of CoQ10, or you're going to poison your mitochondria.
Oh, okay.
Don't want my mitochondria poisoned.
Your mitochondria, when you lose mitochondria, when you drop below a certain threshold, the cell dies.
Ew.
And so this is how you lose brain cells.
That's what's happened to me.
That's a piece of it.
I thought it was the other, you know, drug that's
Yeah. Oh. Hey, thank you for the call. Good question.
Okay, de nada. Ciao.
Bye-bye. And you are on the air with Dr. Don.
Hi, thank you. Well, what's a mitochondriac?
Mitochondriac, I love it. Well, a mitochondria is inside each body cell, all of them, every single one of them. There are these little tiny things that make energy. And you've got about 18 seconds of energy in your body. So if all the, this is why cyanide kills you, because cyanide turns off the mitochondria. And if you take cyanide, you've got literally 18 seconds and you're dead. And it propagates to your body, and that's all she wrote. So mitochondria make ATP. ATP is your gasoline. It's the thing that runs everything, your brain, your heart, everything that's going on in your body, all the enzyme reactions, the digestion, it all depends on ATP. And you use it, and then you remake it, and you use it, and then you remake it, and that's all going on in the mitochondria. And so that's what they are. And you need as many of them in as good a shape as possible. And as we age, they deteriorate and get less efficient, and we make less energy, and we start to... Well, our skin gets a little funky. Our hair doesn't grow as well. Things get, you know, more rigid. Basically, it either sags or gets stiff.
And, oh, God.
And always in the wrong way that you don't want it to go.
Go
John,
ahead. Yes.
We both surf, and we know how exhilarating, how joyful it is. And
absolutely.
I think the doctor really explained why some people can be just such mean holes about it.
Yeah. People out there aren't very nice a lot.
And these guys are just bad.
There's an attitude with people who surf too much. Anyway, hey, thanks for your call. Always a pleasure to hear from you. Okay, so we'll go on with a question. That'll make the phone ring. It always does. Am I saying it correctly?
You had norovirus, sometimes called the cruise ship diarrhea bug.
Yeah.
Norovirus is really, really contagious. And while it's usually spread from person to person, contaminated food, you know, not washing your hands after using the bathroom. But the truth of the matter is, if you just walk into a bathroom that somebody's vomited in, and it's 20 feet away, the stall that they vomited in, you can breathe in the virus.
Oh, God.
So that's how come, and it tends to get into the water supply. And so that's how come cruise ships tend to have real problems. It's difficult once it gets into the environment to clean it. Hand sanitizers don't work. Ultraviolet radiation doesn't work particularly well either. And we don't have a vaccine.
So it's all not good news.
It rarely kills you unless you're already kind of on the ropes and ready to be knocked over by the first breeze, and this is more than a breeze.
Yeah, it's one of the most uncomfortable diseases I've ever had. Let's take a call. Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don.
How do you spell the good doctor's name?
D-A-W-N.
M-O-T-Y-K-A.
I have more questions than we have time, but I just have to express how much I appreciate your whole perspective of the scientific model instead of all this other stuff. And in addition, the woman who called in about the alkaline and acidity, you could probably figure out, forgive me for doing this, but you could probably figure out a whole show on that, because I've been into this for years, and it is confusing, as you could tell from this lady that called, and she was quite, I thought, helpful in her questions by your answers.
Well, I sure hope so. Did you want to ask a question?
Yeah, and it is critical because at the end of the day, we all need to keep our inflammation down.
That's right.
And I don't know, tell me what is the most, if there was only one or two things we could do, what would that be to keep our inflammation down? No sugar, I'm guessing.
Well, okay, there's two things that sugar do. The sugar would probably be the one. Very mild amounts of sugar because it doesn't exist in nature. And when you eat sugar, you release an enzyme, you release a hormone called insulin, which you've probably heard of. And we're built to have insulin be released in certain short periods of time when there's a whole bunch of stuff that we need to digest, like the summer, when there's all this ripe fruit and you're just chowing down and filling up because winter's coming. And our body it basically says, all right, I'm going to do the sugar marathon for a couple of weeks and build up all this fat. And then I'm going to stop and live off that fat. But what we do is we live in the land of perpetual summer and we always have sugar. And our body's insulin's toxic when it's present all the time at high levels. It's a driver for cancer. It's a driver for Alzheimer's. It interferes with all sorts of physiological processes. It's very pro-inflammatory. So the first thing we need to do is get the sugar and the simple carbohydrates, which would include like refined flour, even whole wheat flour, out of our diets and down to smaller amounts rather than being the staple that it is. So that would be the first thing. The second thing I would do is say stay away from all vegetable oils that cannot be made without a hydraulic press. So that means basically olive oil. You're pretty much stuck with olive oil, and that's about it. Because
but even olive oil is cold pressed.
Yes, but it's cold. But the Greeks could make it with rocks. So you don't need a hydraulic press. You can squeeze the oil out at very, very low pressures. And
what's wrong with hydraulic if you're not using chemicals?
The problem is that those seeds that they're making that oil out of are high in omega-6 fatty acids. And we don't ordinarily have omega-6 fatty acids at high levels in our diet until about 1860, 1840, when they start getting sunflower oil and safflower oil, and they start taking oil, soybean oil, and making seeds into oil. And it's all high omega-6, and omega-6 is super high inflammatory because it's the backbone of the inflammatory chemical prostaglandin, and which is a huge player in inflammation. And if you make the prostaglandin out of omega-6, it's much more aggressive, an inflammatory mediator, than if you make it out of the omega-3s. And we used to have a much more balanced omega-3 to omega-6 in balance in our diet, and we move that. And also, if you eat meat, if the animal is pasture-fed versus corn-fattened, it's going to have a very different omega-3 ratio in its flesh. So when you say, red meat's bad for you and causes cancer, that's all based on feedlot beef. I'm not even sure it's true for lean, free-range animal meat. I don't think anyone's ever done that science to show that one way or another. But that's an aside. In any event, omega-6 bad, omega-3 good. If you lower your, if you're eating kind of paleo, so to speak, and I know that's become a terrible food fad, but the basic concept that Cordain came up with when he wrote the very, very first book on the paleo diet was he was saying, eat what you were evolved to eat. Don't go eating stuff that isn't, that's industrial. And, the Industrial Revolution starts in the 1700s. And by the 1800s, it's rolling majorly and the food sources have all been changed.
Does that mean no spray on cheese?
It means no spray on cheese.
Oh, dang.
That's not cheese.
I know.
That's not cheese. That is a cheese-like substance.
Yes, exactly. It's like butter.
Right. Certainly don't want that. Now, just in response to your specific comments about omega-3 and 6, my understanding was that it was balanced. If you had it balanced, that is preferable to having a little bit of too much 3 or too much 6.
Yeah, the question, and I think that's true. You need both. Plus, not all omega 6s are created are pro-inflammatory. So, we're here on a popular radio program, so we can't get take too deep a dive, or we'll lose our audience. But thank you so much for your questions, and I'm very intrigued. I'll be looking forward to hearing from you.
And hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don.
Hi, I heard about these collagen peptides, which I imagine have a lot of amino acids. You're talking about all that,
mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, can those be bad for you in some quantity greater than what they might recommend?
Well, I mean, not to my knowledge, really, unless they're doctoring them, because, it's just amino acids. So effectively, it's you can make, what do they call it, bone broth, right? And you're taking the collagen and the calcium out of the bone and dissolving it and drinking it. And you can take the gooey stuff that comes on the inside of a canned ham. That's basically pure, that gooey pink stuff. That's pure collagen. And, it's a little salty. It's a little sweet. It's not bad. I used to really like it when I was a kid. But the...
pickled pig's feet too?
Not so much. I like it when when I was a child, the less it looked like an actual animal, the better off I was. I didn't want to be reminded what I was eating. But getting back to the collagen peptides, if you only ate amino acids and didn't eat anything else, that would be a very unbalanced diet, and it would be bad for you. So I guess you could say that you could get too much of it, but it would be difficult.
Okay. And another substance that is in the popular is turmeric extract or
mm-hmm.
turmeric,
right.
and I know they're hard to absorb, and they talk about combining them with things to make the make them more effective or more absorbed into your system. And I'm just wondering if when you mix that kind of thing with one of these shakers, and you can put just about every good thing you ever heard about, even if you know what it's for, into mm-hmm. one of those things and shake it up, and you got this,
this homogenized thin pudding that you then choke down. Yes,
yeah.
I do it every morning.
Well, it's quite liquid. You can put in cinnamon and turmeric.
Oh yeah, you can make it taste good. Okay,
just about anything you've ever heard of, and throw it in there, and it doesn't taste necessarily terrible. But it's it becomes like breakfast or something. But
yeah, well, that's my that's been my breakfast for the last probably 15 years. Is protein powder, blueberries. I throw in a couple teaspoons of fish oil and. Some vitamin powder and one of those freeze-dried fruit and veggie powders and some fiber and I've been doing that forever, and I really miss it when I go on vacation and have to subsist on omelets and bacon. It's just it's a struggle. I miss my shake, believe it or not. It's true.
Let me ask something while you're right on this subject.
Yeah.
Excuse me, caller, but I know somebody who eats rice, couple of eggs and bacon pretty much every morning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where is that not a good idea?
Sort
of a farmer's breakfast is what I call it.
It depends on so many things. It depends on their activity level. It depends on whether or not they're getting adequate antioxidants in their diet, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Ultimately, I don't particularly like to mix fat and simple carbohydrates, because if you eat, let's say, a big cup of rice and, fried rice, let's say, and you've got the fat that you fried it in will not get absorbed. It'll get absorbed. It won't be processed to the extent that you kick your insulin levels up.
But if you cook it in, say, fry it up in olive oil, then a little better.
Well, as long as you don't let the olive oil smoke, because
yes.
then it's not healthy anymore. Yeah, there's all kinds of all kinds of details. But ultimately, you can get your diet sufficiently unbalanced with good things to be in trouble. Back to the turmeric, I wanted to address that for a second. There's a compound called curcumin that's a subfraction in turmeric. This stuff absolutely works wonders for turning off that whole inflammatory cascade of prostaglandins that we go after with ibuprofen and naproxen and prednisone, for that matter. So you can block the formation of prostaglandins with curcumin and turmeric, and it's great stuff. The easiest, cheapest way to do it is buy powdered bulk turmeric and put 90% turmeric to 10% ground black pepper and mix it up and put it in capsules and take it with some oil. So, you know, a tablespoon of olive oil and five or six of those double zero size capsules. So those are the big ones that hold 500 milligrams because you'd need about two or three teaspoons of turmeric with this mixture for the dose of curcumin, which is 500 milligrams in there. So you basically, it's 10% curcumin. You put the pepper in so you can pull the curcumin and get it absorbed. The fat helps it absorb as well. And it's a lot of turmeric to figure out how to eat. So that's why I recommend putting it in capsules. But that's the cheapest way to do it.
Yeah, and I found 95% curcumin in a, you know, either 250-gram bag or 1,000-gram bag in online on the order of 20 cents a gram, which I thought was, you know, not too crazy expensive. But, well, maybe my calculation's wrong, but it was a sizable bag of this extremely staining orange powder.
Yeah, that would be turmeric, not curcumin, though.
But it said 95% extract in it. I don't know.
Interesting.
So is it,
okay. Well, I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't know how they did it. So, I'm like, show me your independent lab certification that you've actually got. You know that. And by the way, you never buy anything from anybody who doesn't have an independent lab looking at it and giving them a certificate, because a lot of stuff now is being sourced right out of China, and
they don't care.
Well, they have some severe pollution issues.
Oh,
plus,
God.
They have kind of an ethics issue.
The ethics, I think, is a strong one.
And I think I could say that they just haven't had the regulatory environment. So maybe it's not ethics. Maybe it's fear that keeps people in line on this side of the Pacific. But whatever it is, it's a wild west out there, and people were doing just horrible stuff, knowingly adulterating product and then selling them within and outside of China. It's a terrible thing.
Hi, you're the last caller, and you're on with Dr. Don.
I have a question about this flu virus.
Sure.
Yes. Last night on the local news on TV, they said this was a pandemic. And they said something that I wasn't aware of, and I wanted to check it out with you.
Sure.
They said that they're actually, well, we're right in the middle of it. We're not out of the woods yet, but it's not just one, H1N1. There are two strains, they said, H1N2. Is that correct?
I think it's H3N2, actually, is the main virus that we're dealing with. And the problem with the virus is that it splits, and it's kind of rapidly reproducing, obviously. And every time it goes through a new human, the virus that human spits out is subtly different than the virus that made them sick, because it mutates so fast. It mutates even with the passage through one body. And so the vaccine that we start off with, that we made because we knew what they were getting sick with in Australia, by the time, and this one has been a really fast mutator, and so that's been part of the problem, is that the vaccine is not as effective because it's not as targeted as we would like. What we really need, and talking to the conspiracy theory that that John was mentioning earlier, or someone was, what we really need is we need a flu vaccine that's against the core backbone of the flu virus, not the H and the N, because those keep changing. And if we had that, then we could vaccinate just once, or maybe every 10 years, like we do for tetanus, and we'd be golden, and it wouldn't matter what the flu virus did, because we'd be attacking the backbone. But there isn't really funding within the pharmaceutical industry, because there is a flu industrial complex. There's a lot of money being made off of flu vaccine every year. And there's
so
a whole-
I want to know, I'd like to know, if, like myself, you get one strain of the flu, and you get right after, can you get the second strain?
Yes, but not very likely that you will, because there's certain amount of cross, you've got tons of antibodies at this point, and so you'll probably have a certain amount of, it's kind of what we call cross tolerance. That's not quite the term, but it's close enough. So, like, for example, when we used to vaccinate against smallpox, we didn't use the smallpox virus. We used the cowpox virus, because if you made antibodies to cowpox, it would also attack smallpox. And so if you're making a lot of antibodies to flu, which you are at the end of the 2 weeks that you've had the flu, some of those will probably attack the other flu that's wandering around. So it's most of the time you don't see people getting both strains. It's theoretically possible, but it usually doesn't happen.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.